Today's program is brought to you by GreatBrewers.com, a social media marketing platform dedicated to promoting the world's great brewers and the beers they create. For more information, visit GreatBrewers.com.
I'm Laura Stanley, host of Inside School Food. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good evening and welcome to
Fomen About It
on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Isaac.
And I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And we're your co-hosts of this weekly journey of all things fermented.
Archived on iTunes, Stitcher, and right here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
All right, let's go ahead with the announcements. So first up is Kuzmi and I are doing a Valentine's Day beer, cheese, and chocolate pairing at Jimmy's number 43 this Saturday on actual Valentine's Day. What time does it start, excuse me?
That starts at 8 o'clock p.m. You can find more information about that on jimmysno43.com. I'll also be playing saxophone with a piano player to be determined who the piano player is, but probably Gabriel Jordowski, who is pretty awesome, and we have a lot of fun playing together, and I'm going to play some sweet, sweet melodious etudes to go
Absolutely.
With your beer, chocolate, and cheese.
And this is not just for pairs, for couples. This is for open to everybody. We're just going to be celebrating cheese, chocolate, beer, and a little bit of jazz.
There'll be four pairings of beer, chocolate, and cheese, followed by a chocolate and spirit pairing, because Jimmy's just got his license to serve spirits. So
all New York State spirits.
That's right. So we're going to close out with that. Be fun. Also coming up at the end of the month is New York City Beer Week. There's a lot of stuff going on with that. The events are numerous, but the main ones are the opening tap on Friday, February 20th at bars around New York City. Each bar is going to feature a different rare or unique keg and tap it at 7 o'clock. The idea, it will be listed at nycbg.com what beers are being tapped so that you can kind of plan your own pub crawl and go visit places you haven't seen based on the beers that they have to offer. Opening Bash is on Saturday the 21st, and that's going to be a lot of fun. That's going to be at the Altman Building from 1 to 4 p.m. Also,
that's in Chelsea, by the way.
That's in Chelsea, right in Manhattan. And then on February 22nd, this is not an official New York City Beer Week event, but it is officially awesome. It's Brunity at the Bell House. Brunity is the collective of homebrew clubs and homebrew stores. It's going to be from 1 to 5 p.m. At the Bell House. Find out more information about that at brunity.com, B-R-E-W-N-I-T-Y.
There's going to be some killer lineup of homebrews there.
50 plus, and I've been talking to, we're going to have a band of brewsicians, actually, so we're going to have a set of some wonky tunes of what, and I think I might rewrite the lyrics to Can't Touch This, dedicated to all the beer drinkers out there. Can't drink this, you know, in honor of beer, BJCP judging. And stuff.
I thought you were going to talk about Can't Touch This and sanitation or something.
Oh, yeah, could be that. Yeah, that works too. That'll be a verse. We'll work it out. Anyway, I'm going to get my rap on. We'll figure that out.
And on Tuesday is Brewer's Choice.
That's right. And that's going to be at Waverly next to Kelsey. Kelso, what's the address of Kelso?
529.
529. That voice, you've heard it before.
Episode 29.
Awesome voice. Very experienced guy. We'll talk about him in a second. But what is Brewer's Choice?
Brewer's Choice is a celebration of
food and beer. Yep. And one of the cool things about it is that there's a smash. We've done it. It's in conjunction with the Brewers Association. We're talking about pumping up New York State agriculture, local grains, and how it works within the brewing community. So a lot of the requirement for every brewer that's participating in this, they had to make a beer using at least 30% of New York State grains. And to that note, also with the Brewers Guild, we all made a smash beer. Smash being, in this case, state malt and state hops. And this leads me to the next announcement that Mary and I
have started our own beer architect company, for lack of better terms. We're basically gypsy brewing. So we have brewed our first beer at Greenpoint, home of Kelso and Heartland beers, and a lot of other great beers come out of that. So we brewed 15 barrels of a Cousette Grisette, a session-style farmhouse ale made with New York State malts and hops. And Chris tasted it today.
It's tasting lovely. It's tasting awesome. We're very, very, very excited to launch this during Beer Week.
So we'll be pouring that as Brewer's Choice, and then it'll be at bars around New York City as well. So this is kind of our little Pillow Talk Part 2, Cousette Libations.
That's right. I'd be remiss not to mention the final two events, one of them being an event at Arrogant Swine. We're having a sausage fest with Josh Bernstein and Tyson Ho. It's going to be half commercial, half homebrew kegs at this party. Tickets are $45. You can find more at Josh Bernstein, Joshua M. Bernstein.
Actually, they're $40 through the end of today.
Aha.
So if you want to get in on this, do it today. And last but not least...
Last but not least is our closing bash for the New York City Beer Week. The closer is going to be a brunch at Brooklyn Bowl. And
there's a lot of other great events. I would be remiss in not mentioning, I know that Rich from Bridge and Tunnel is hosting a great sideshow kind of pizza action event on Wednesday of that week. So definitely check out New York City Beer Week. Web address?
You could go to nycbg.com, NewYorkCityBrewersGuild.com as well. Yeah.
So there's a lot of the bars and breweries will be celebrating. So, you know, get out there and get your drink on.
And for all of you very far away, sorry for spending 6 minutes talking about local stuff. We hope you can visit us sometime. Please come. You can stay on Mary Knight's couch, right?
Yeah.
See? Awesome. What's happening today, Mary?
Oh, today. So, all right. So Chris and I helped judge Homebrew Alley number 9. So that is New York City's homebrew premier, one and only BJCP AHA certified homebrew competition. It's the 9th year. We had 666 entries.
That showed up.
Yeah. We had a great time judging. Lo and behold, the sours category was swept by some of our favorite people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you've been listening all along, you heard them on episode number 29, Wood from the Hood. So they have returned. So we're missing one of you guys, but we have Oscar Neulander and Peter Salmond in the studio. Eric is in Rome, apparently, so he couldn't make it. But you guys took first, second, third in the sour category.
Yeah, it's no big deal.
So what are the toughest categories? What are the toughest styles, loose styles?
I'm sorry, you can keep talking. I was just pointing out. I want you to mention what they were.
I know, I'm getting there.
You're doing great, Mary. You're doing great. I just was patting you on the back, that's all.
I thought we got disqualified for a second, like via the internet.
So that is category 17. The sour category encompasses a number of sour styles, but that is definitely one of the most challenging, difficult, and intimidating styles of beer to brew and brew well. So it's absolutely impressive. How many entries did you guys put into that category?
We put 7 into that category.
7. So you took 3 and then...
And there were 35 entries in total, so that's important to know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you didn't sweep it by being the only entrance. It's not a sweep by default.
Absolutely not. So you guys took first with your Guza. You took 2 with Passion of the Wood, which is a passion fruit lambic style. That's 17F for those of you who are BJCP-ites. And then number 3 was a Frambois Lambic, 17F fruit lambic.
Also, congratulations to Bill Carley, who got runner-up. That means that the New York City Home Brewers Guild
swept all.
Swept.
Yeah.
We rock here.
Yeah.
So let's start with the Guza. So last time when you guys were on... We talked a lot about barrels. Mm-hmm. So you have 2 barrels, one that you got that was a Zinfandel wine barrel, 30 gallons, I believe.
Yeah, yes. Right.
So that you guys have been using. And then you had another barrel.
We have a little barrel. It's a 12 gallon. It's currently inactive, but that's my fault. I'm sorry.
And most of these, the Guza came out of the 30 gallon barrel, correct? You guys had a lot of beers that came out of that.
All of our lambic style beers come out of that.
All 3 of these beers came out of the same barrel. There was some process that changed the beers after the barrel, but all 3 of them came out of the same barrel that won this year.
Awesome.
And like we talked about on the first show, just to recap, into this barrel, you make a very light beer being 50% Pilsner, 25% malted wheat, and 25% unmalted wheat?
Pretty much. There's occasionally some variances depending on what malts we have available. Sometimes, we didn't grab everything that we wanted to, pretty much Pilsner or pale, and then wheat.
And at the time, you were a professional brewer. You were head brewer at Greenpoint Beer Works,
right?
And things have changed,
which we are talking about a lot.
But now you're still a professional brewer.
I am still a professional brewer. Correct. I'm brewing at Brooklyn Brewery these days.
Awesome. So let's go back to the recipe. Yeah,
I only brought that up because on the episode you were like, oh yeah, being in a brewery all day, I have access to certain stuff, and I'll be able to, when you take 5 gallons worth of, you know, a small batch worth of grain, it's not a big deal. And so you've got a lot of grain easily around. It's always around.
There's, definitely a lot of access to ingredients.
Yeah.
But you guys are using, so it's a very basic recipe that you're using for all of them.
Yeah. One thing we are starting to change a little bit is our mashing. We've always done, I mean, I know like turbine mashes and other more complex stuff.
So let's go back for people that are, you know, beginners or they're not familiar with sours. What is a turbine mash?
I'm trying to remember because I've never done one.
All right, let's get that. Let's go. Keep going.
But we've done just, you know, single infusion mashes.
Right.
We used to do them, you know, pretty much normal temp, like 156 or something like that.
Yeah, but 152, 156, somewhere in there.
Yeah. Now we're starting to go even higher, up to as high as like 162, 164.
I think the last one was almost 166.
Wow. So you're getting a lot of residual sugar from that, correct?
We're hoping to get more complex, like dextrins and other things that can't be broken down by the traditional yeasts, you know, to kind of give the Brett more food to feast on for a long period of time.
Right. This last time that we brewed, so we used to all live together, and we don't anymore for the last about year and a half. I think last time we were on the radio with you guys was right after we, you know, had broken up the band. And so since then, we've barely brewed together. We've done a couple of batches, and the last few were the first ones that we really started talking about, you know, technique. What have we done? What could we do differently? And how can we make this beer better? Since we're making less of it, let's make it better. So especially this last batch, I think we really pushed the temperature, and I really feel like that made a big difference. Yeah, 166, and by the time that it, you know, cooled down, we did the mash rest 166, and I think it only cooled down to about 158 after about an hour. Then, you know, did run off typical the way that you normally would, you know, usual boil and everything like that. But the time that it normally takes to ferment, it only fermented down from about 1056, 1060, I think we started at on this last
around
one. And it was only down to about 1016, whereas normally we'd be down almost immediately down to about, you know, 1010, 1008.
Mm-hmm. And that's with primary saccharomyces? Or
we've pretty much always gone
Lambic Smack Pack.
Yeah, the Lambic Blend Smack Pack from Y East. Mm-hmm. And we've done a couple of vials from White Labs into the barrel, Lactobacillus pediococcus. But we usually just do all of our primary fermentation with the YE Smackback Lambic blend.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So before you guys were doing this high temperature, you were getting that's when you were getting down to like 10-10 or something pretty quickly, right?
Yeah,
even with the same blend.
Yeah.
It was a very fermentable wort.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Awesome. So I'm going to go back because I did have to look up turbine mash just to be so I don't get it wrong on the radio. So basically, it's similar, the goal is to break down larger proteins of the wheat and malt into free amino acids and produce a wort high in dextrins and starches. So you're basically removing some of the liquid portion of the mash, boiling it, and then reintroducing. So you guys are kind of doing a shortcut version of that.
Yeah.
Or related, but a much easier way. Yeah, that's a much easier way process.
Trying to duplicate that by not doing that.
Yeah, exactly. Without all the mess.
I know. We're lazy.
So then you guys are doing traditional mash boil or like, you know, this high temperature mash, typical boil. You're hitting it with this mixed culture. And then when does it go? Are you guys going into carboys or you're going straight into the barrel?
We are putting it into carboys and then often racked off into like, you know, corny kegs. We, you know, at times we've given it, you know, 8-9 months even, but oftentimes maybe 2 to 4
months. In the carboy?
Yeah, in carboy or often a lot of that in kegs,
yeah.
You know, after we get it kind of off the yeast. But yeah, we like to give it some time to kind of develop before we introduce it. And also it's often timing wise, like when do we want to pull stuff out? When do we want to make some batches, you know, with like the fruits and other things like that?
So when you guys are racking it off a primary into a keg, then you're going to let that keg set there. What's the longest you think that you have let it sit in the keg? And successfully introduced it to a barrel later?
Probably no more than 4 months.
Okay.
Usually we'll brew stuff to be put into the barrel, because the sooner we have beer ready for the barrel, the sooner we can get stuff off the barrel so we can reintroduce it. So if we do a Solera system, and because of that, you know, the faster we have something to put back in, the sooner we can get stuff out.
Right.
And everything that we've made that's come out of the barrel, we still have to replace it. And so if you don't have anything to replace it with, then you're just stuck looking at a really, really pretty barrel.
But you guys are so when you're putting stuff into the barrel, you're not necessarily, you don't have like a deadline of time. It's a range, you know, it could be some of it's younger and some of it's more.
I think the earliest we've done is about 2 months after brew date. And I think the longest is probably about 6 months after brew date.
That's cool. That's good to know.
And that barrel has been full since you got it? Or when you moved, you emptied it and then.
It was empty for like, 48, 72 hours, something like that. When we moved, we put in some kegs. Move that over. One thing that's kind of important to note, where I think the character's starting to change, is before it was like in a basement laundry room, which I think kept the temperature more steady, kept the temperature more in like the 60s.
And tile floors, real consistent.
Yeah, but now it's in a fifth floor living room, which, you know, I don't think is that ideal in the summer with kind of AC sometimes, not other times, and heat in the winter. It's I feel like, I kind of wish I did have better temp control, but, you know, I don't have space to put the barrel in the refrigerator or anything like that or something.
And it's been pretty good this year, though.
It's yeah.
And on that note, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back with more sours on Ferment About It.
So, you like good beer. Whether you're a craft beer pro or just had your first sip of an IPA, GreatBrewers.com is your number one beer resource on the internet. GreatBrewers.com bridges the gap between the world's great brewers and the consumers who enjoy their products. With so much information and misinformation out there, GreatBrewers.com focuses on education and leaves no stone unturned. Take the Great Beer Test on their website and browse through an extensive product catalog. Download their mobile Beer Cloud app, which includes a GPS beer finder, a beer sommelier, and descriptions for over 5,000 different brews. What are you waiting for? Back up that passion for craft beer with some solid information and education. Visit GreatBrewers.com today.
This is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Welcome back to Ferment About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We're here in the studio with Peter Samland and Oscar Norlander, two of our favorite homebrewers. They actually, along with Oscar's brother Eric, swept category number 17 in the latest Homebrew Alley number nine, and also took best in show for their Goozer.
We neglected to mention that
we have a question from the audience. The audience is actually in the room where I say hi to Dave over there. Dave Sharfstein, hey, welcome to Ferment About It.
Dave.
Dave wants to know whether you guys agree with the order of the judges. Which one was your favorite? So the first was the Goose, second was Passion of the Wood, third was Frambois Lambic. Do you agree with the judges' decisions?
Yes. but I will say this. We all were talking like a couple days before about predictions.
Uh-huh.
Yes. So the night of the competition, Oscar, was one of the judges. And
I should mention that I don't get to judge the categories I'm entered in. I only was judging other categories.
Correct. All judges is done blindly. There's no names or anything, and you're not allowed to judge a category that you are entered in. But when we found out that he was not able to judge the best in show, it became really, really exciting for us. just because that meant we, you know, hopefully had a chance. You know, it could just mean they had enough judges, but it also could mean that we, you know, were in the running. So the brain starts going wild. You know, what could it be? What do you think it was? We entered 10 beers.
Which of these 10?
What is it?
Yeah.
So we started talking. This was before Eric had to fly to Rome, because he did come to Alewife for the beginning of it. And he had to leave right at the beginning of the announcements of all the awards. And so we're talking about all the different sours that it could be, since that was the category that we entered the most in. And I actually thought it was going to be the Frambois. I thought the fruit was fantastic, very spot on. I thought the sour was delicious. The color was great. And so that was my pick for number one, and that got number three.
Yeah, my brother did pick the passion fruit. He really liked that one a lot. And I mean, it's a wonderful beer that we're drinking right now.
This is amazing.
Cheers.
So,
cheers.
Yeah, speaking of passion, well, passion fruit, how did you get the passion? So last time I know you guys, from the last show, use a lot of purees, right?
Still do.
So yeah. Talk about, where did you get passion fruit puree? What form? Was it frozen, canned?
Yeah, I was kind of talking with them a couple years ago even, and I'd mentioned kind of wanting to go, we've done a lot more like forest fruits, like blueberry, blackberry, raspberry, and they've been very good. But I kind of wanted to try something a little tropical, especially because the neighborhood we were living in was kind of a Caribbean neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And I went to Chelsea Market there, the Italian place there, because I'd heard they had a lot of the frozen purees there. And they do. They have like, you know, 20 kinds.
Buon Italia. It's an amazing Italian grocery store in Chelsea Market.
Yeah. And yeah, they even got a few vegetable purees, but I don't know if I'm ready to try that.
But split pea lambic.
Yeah.
But I think I ended up like texting them like five different ideas or three or four. I can't remember what the others were off the top of my head, but like mango maybe or something like that. And I was leaning passion fruit, and I think everybody kind of agreed with that. So I grabbed a kilo of passion fruit, figuring passion fruit is pretty strong compared to some of the other fruits. So a kilo would probably go a pretty long way with about, usually we're mixing about like 4.5 gallons.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, we do all of our fruit mixes in a corny keg.
So this is post-barrel.
Right. Mm-hmm. Post-barrel. We don't ever put fruit into the barrel. Since we do a Solera, we always want to keep the barrel kind of clean and the same. So we can do something like the goose.
So when do you decide when liquid is ready to be pulled out in the barrel?
As soon as we have liquid to put in the barrel. We should be brewing more. We keep talking about, let's brew more. And I don't know, it's the long game.
Part of it is also evaporation. You know, you're seeing the level kind of go down. You're like, well, we should be topping it off. So maybe we can pull some out. Add some there.
But you're finding that most of the liquid that comes... Well, first of all, what do you think the average amount of time that your beer is in the barrel?
It could be
a range.
It's tough because there's some in there left over from everything.
I mean,
from when you move it.
System. I mean, now the barrel's 3.5 years old, approximately, over.
45 months. We first filled it July 2011, so...
Yeah. Just over 3.5 years, and... So, yeah, there's some of it there. I guess
it's reliably coming out sour.
We're probably
at this
pulling.
Point, right? I mean, you're getting kind of a reliable liquid at this point.
We're pulling about a third a year, so I guess the average is still pretty old.
Yeah.
Maybe half a year. I mean, yeah. So, yeah, the average is probably several years old.
Okay.
Even after the move? Or was it empty when the move? So the new.
Well, you put all.
But we put all the stuff back in.
Yeah. Ah,
so you took it out to move it and then put it back in when you got.
Yeah, yeah. It wasn't all fresh beer at that point,
right,
and that was in like April of 2013.
Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah. Fascinating.
I have to say, I mean, this is absolutely amazing. I mean, the passion fruit. I didn't get to judge sours. I was. They needed me in ciders. Yes, it's Saturday afternoon, but I volunteered to steward the mini Best of Show at the sours table, and I will say that 11 sours were put forward. We had four different judging teams. And normally that's kind of high, but there were there were so many great sours entered in that category.
With 35 entries, I mean, that's kind of crazy for the
sour 11
category.
All
and again, you know, it's a very difficult category to judge. Those are very difficult categories to brew. There's a wide range of aromas and flavors and everything.
And styles.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, so many, like, the lambic styles are a bit similar, but then you got something like a Berliner Weiss in there, which is a very different style.
Yeah. So I did get to taste a lot of these, but, I mean, I'm so impressed. The aroma is just... amazing passion fruit. I love passion fruit. And it really, not only is it an amazing, really captures the kind of esoteric essence of passion fruit, but it also is super complementary to the sour profile as well. So
I think it's better than we even hoped for.
We had
high expectations. And when we got the frozen puree, we opened it up and, you know, it's a plastic tub with a plastic lid and you peel it off and it just immediately just smelled so good, and you dip your finger in it and taste it, and it's amazing and tart and sweet and just very aromatic and fruity, and just everything I've never had in a sour beer and everything I've ever wanted in a sour beer.
So, you know, those of you who are out there that don't have access to some place like Buon Italia, or Clusians also, I think, carries the same similar purees. Clusians in Lexington and 28th area in New York City. But definitely, I mean, there's a lot of international stores and international groceries all across America now. So regardless of what kind of international store you have in your area, check it out, man. You never know what you can find.
Yeah.
Goya and Lafay make some great pasteurized purees.
Yeah.
You want the pasteurized, not preservatives, right?
Yeah, you're talking about 100% frozen puree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I will say you can also order them like off of Amazon and stuff like that, but the shipping is really rough, where the cost ends up being oftentimes three times as much as buying it locally.
Yeah.
But it's certainly an option, and there you will get the full range. Because even with 20 there, I think that brand, I can't remember the name of it, they make like 40, I think.
Different kinds of fruits, yeah.
Yeah, they make like everything you can imagine. I will say one thing when choosing kind of fruits for lambics, I do find kind of the tartar fruits are a better balance. Some of the tartar berries, like raspberries, blackberries, stuff like the passion fruit that has kind of a tart edge, just plays with it so well. Mm-hmm. Because if you have another fruit, like maybe a strawberry, I think would be tricky, because with a strawberry, you don't expect it to be tart. So when it's a tart beer with strawberries, it might not quite taste the way you'd imagine it.
Yeah, I would agree with you. So let's talk about your number one winner, the Guza. So tell me about its path to bottling.
So the same start to the path, we had to empty the barrel. Mm-hmm. So we had brewed some beer to, you know, get ready for the barrel. And so this is a blend of 40-month aged lambic. Oh, and frothy. So 40-month lambic blended with some about 6-month-old non-barrel-aged sour that we'd brewed to refill the barrel. So this is, you know, as kind of traditional as we can get with the lambic on our system in Brooklyn. And it's just, you know, it's old and young blended together, but, you know, basically 50-50 as far 50-50. As the amount.
And how'd you guys decide to do... So I feel like this bottle is actually... So I judged Best of Show, even though I didn't judge a sour category. I did judge Best of Show.
What was that table like, Mary?
It was amazing. Honestly, so the first time I ever judged Best of Show was, I think, fall of 2006 at the Snort competition in Connecticut. And so of the 9 years I've been judging Best of Show tables, that was honestly the most impressive Best of Show table I've ever... Usually, you know, there's three or four beers. So Best of Show, how it works is it's the winner from every category. Mm-hmm. So these are number one first place beers. And usually, though, even though that's the case, they all won their category. Usually there's like three or four right away that you can say, hey, we don't, you know, these are not as good as the rest of them. Yeah. This time it was just simply not that case. So going back to the Guza, so it was a blend. How'd you guys decide to do 50-50?
A lot of that, it's kind of guesswork. Because we usually have kegs of stuff that's getting ready to go into the barrel, and then we also are pulling stuff out of the barrel first to make room for the new stuff. So you're kind of looking at, you know, how much of which do you have. Mm-hmm. So it's not specifically a, you know, tasting and weighing it or anything like that. We don't put it on a scale and weigh it out. It's mostly just, you know, how does it taste, and let's try to go 50-50. I think we've done a Goose pretty much every year since we started doing the barrel.
Yeah.
At least, you know, about a year after we started pulling stuff out of the barrel.
And one thing which we didn't do this year, which we'd done every year, was a straight lambic. Just kind of, I don't know, we didn't...
I don't think we had as much as we had in years past, just since we haven't been brewing as much.
Yeah, and we often found that although we liked the straight lambics, we felt like the Goose and the fruits were even better. So we felt that... it was better to try to make some more interesting, creative stuff.
Yeah, I really like this because you definitely get the kind of that tart. And also, I always compare it to old Rieslings, that kind of petrol note that really good Gooses and also some lambics have. So you kind of get that tart, almost petrol intensity up front. And then in the middle is this really nice, soft kind of sweet tart sugar, like...
Yeah,
you know, like not malty sweetness that's not overwhelming. It's still balanced. You know, the tartness sticks throughout. And then that nice sour, you know, petrol comes behind. So it's really has a lot of, you know, it's a nice path in your mouth.
I really like that you can still taste the barrel. Mm-hmm. You can still taste the Zinfandel barrel that's in here.
Yeah.
But it's not as strong. You know, some of the straight lambics that we've had have been a little bit more barrel forward, which are almost aggressively sort of winey. And I think this is just a little bit softer, and I think we have, you know, really nice carbonation that's appropriate. And I just think it turned out great.
Now, you guys said you did not bottle condition these, correct?
No.
So tell us how you prepped your bottles for Homebrew Alley, because I think that's something a lot of people, have a hard time with. Do I bottle condition? Do I,
We did a little bit of bottle conditioning the first couple times we entered Homebrew Alley, and the last few years we've pretty much exclusively done force carbonated and counter pressure filled. And so we have a single fill head counter pressure fill where you have the two dials and you're doing one bottle at a time. But I think that you have a little bit more consistency, and I think you have less of a chance of gushers, which is terrible as a judge, as you guys know. But it's just, you get a little bit more of a clean beer. You have, no sediment at the bottom. You know what you're getting.
And I also feel like it's the type of thing I can keep it, 5 days or maybe a couple of years, and hopefully the carbonation will be similar.
Right.
I'm a little afraid of with, the Breton stuff in there, if I put in some sugars over a while, it's just going to get way too carbonated. Yeah. And
especially with the funk.
Yeah.
Because that's still unpredictable, even though you guys have, a kind of a more predictable flavor profile that you're working with. It's still unpredictable as far as fermentability.
Right, right. Especially, when we're adding fruit, there's still residual sugar that's in there. We try to, give it a little bit of time to, finish fermenting in the keg before we, deal with it. But you never know. Some of our, year or two old stuff in bottle, we force carbonate it, but, you still have the boat out caps and, you worry about bottles exploding. I've been pretty happy with the counter pressure filling and just instead of doing a traditional bottle conditioning.
So you guys are continuing with the barrel and your sour program.
Yep.
Are you guys doing other styles? What's kind of the present and future of?
Yeah. We did do an American stout. Yeah,
we got third.
Yeah. I judged that. It was good.
Yeah.
That was
our first brew in a bag, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? Right on.
Yeah. We were trying for an Imperial stout and
didn't quite get there.
Well, it fit right in there in that American stout category. That was delicious. That's great.
Yeah.
And we were already talking American stout, I think, before the brew day had ended. We were already like, okay, maybe it's an American stout. We have a lot of hops in there. And I remember the first time we tasted it, we were almost thinking almost black IPA levels of hoppiness, but we're like, we got a couple months till the competition. Hops are going to die down. And
I think we brewed that in August, and we brewed it early because we were planning on doing Imperial Stout, but because it didn't reach the levels that it should have for that style, we just kind of upped the hops a little bit and gave the hops time to mellow, and I think it really actually balanced out pretty well.
It was great.
Yeah. That's cool. Oh, that's what I wanted to ask you. Going back to the beginning of our conversation, when you guys do a high-temperature mash at 166, are you still getting the same extraction, or have you had to adjust?
This last time we didn't have any problems with extraction. Yeah. It's actually a higher gravity than we were shooting for.
Okay.
We haven't done enough times to really have any good data on that. One thing that's so great about a barrel program like this is you have such a big range on gravity. It's like if one time you get 1040, one time you get 1065, you're just shooting for about maybe a 1054 average.
Yeah.
Then
yeah,
just the next time you adjust the other direction.
Right.
So you can kind of, when you're blending into the barrel, even a 1070 in there isn't going to raise the barrel all that much if you had, 7 gallons of that.
Yeah.
Right.
Cool.
So last time we spoke, you guys were doing it. You were at 155 as your mash temperature. Just, hey, you remember then? Those are good old days. Yeah. Also, to the other thing you were asking, one of the things that I really loved about our first episode, too, was she asked what the future was for your brewing. And, you both looked confused, like you weren't really trying to do anything other than sours. And you spoke to that, but the last one being like, being in New York, we're very fortunate by having access to all these different great beers. You can go to the bodega and you can get those. And it's very rare to make – to get sours at an affordable price, and it's hard to make a really good sour, and you guys are making lots of it, and God damn it, I want to live with you. Sorry, Mary.
Part of it also is, you can clean and sanitize all your equipment and stuff like that, but it's very easy to get cross-contamination between your sour beers and your non-sour beers. And if we're making mostly sours, it's just not that much of a problem.
Yeah.
We really haven't... If we wanted to do a lot more regular, non-sour beers, I would think at some point we'd start labeling our tubing, labeling all our kegs, and going, this is our sour half, this is our non-sour half. Mm-hmm. And
I think we still have a couple of kegs that are marked no sour. That I think those are dying out fast.
Yeah.
No doubt. Awesome.
Well, that was our show on Ferment About It. Thank you, Peter Salmon. Thank you, Eric Norlander.
I keep going
back and forth.
He's here in spirit.
Yeah. Eric Norlander, Oscar Norlander, Dave Sharstein, Jarent David, Mary Isaac.
Thanks to our
Liz
engineer,
Smith.
Liz Smith. Yeah.
Look at that. She's not even waving.
No.
Oh, there she goes. All right. Aww. You just said wave against the airwaves. Check out NewYorkCityBrewersGuild.com to find out what's happening for New York City Beer Week. Come to Brunity. If you're in New York, try our beer. And thank you for listening.
We'll be back next Monday at 7 p.m. with Foment About It.
Foment About It.
Foment About It. Hey.
The theme song for Foment About It has been provided by Chris Kuzmi.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.